Oh, we're back, and I am excited. I am thrilled to be sitting here and ready to talk once again about another great movie. This is what we do on this podcast. It is known as We've Seen That, movies from the 80s, 90s, and more. I'm TJ Reeves. I am based in the Tampa, St. Pete, Clearwater area, West Central Florida. He is the famous Jay Betzel, based in Fort Worth, Texas, DFW, the Metroplex. Good to be back with the famous Jay. How you feeling, big time?
Doing well. How are you, sir?
I'm good. You know, we've done this once or twice, going over all the different movies, and you and I decided to get back together again. Part of this that the audience needs to understand, if you're just now finding this show, this digital on-demand podcast form show, is that Jay and I have known each other for years. We will converse, will we not, Jay, on many different subjects. We'll call each other when games are going on. But the biggest time that you and I get in contact with each other via the phone, the text, or social media is movies. When we've got a movie on, especially on cable or on one of the 27 HBOs that I have, and you and I have seen the movie, we start conversing about the movie. And so that became the genesis of you and I doing a show. And now it's led to what we do with We've Seen That. But that, I mean, for the people that have just found us for the first time, this is now them having a listening ear on what you and I do on a regular basis about movies, right?
Yeah, imagine if this was like the Truman Show or something like that, and people were like kind of watching what we do. You know, basically imagine whenever Presumed Innocence on HBO or Showtime has whatever, one of us randomly texting the other one, and of course we happen to be watching it when we should be doing some work.
Yeah, and I will sometimes just text you like a cable channel, like AMC, and you know what you're like. You'll text me back and go, already watching. That's how sick. That's how sick, sad, savant, whatever you want to call us, that we are between you and me on these movies. So,
You can only watch 16 candles so many times, right? Or actually, not at all, right?
16 candles. Yeah, that's one that we'll have to do maybe down the road. I mean, it's funny because you and I, at the time that we're taping this, I just happened to flip by and the end of Presumed Innocent with Harrison Ford and Bonnie Bedelia is on. And I said to you, hey, it's kind of fortuitous that we're about to do a movie podcast show here on We've Seen That and Presumed Innocent's on. And what did you say to me?
Watching it right now, waiting on you to call.
Unbeknownst to me. Okay, so the subject on this one, as you probably know by now because we've been promoting it, you see it on the label, technology being what it is on this edition of We've Seen That, is The Shawshank Redemption, which is it's such a fascinating movie for so many different reasons. And you and I have seen this many, 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 many times. It's all the time on basic cable now. It seems like, speaking of AMC or Sundance or TNT or one of those channels, it's on all the time. And this movie, Jay, just recently had its anniversary, right? At the time that we are talking, in 2017, it just had an anniversary, correct?
Right, it's 23rd anniversary. It came out on September 23rd, 1994. So about a week or two ago, it celebrated its 23rd anniversary, and it comes on TV all the time. You were not kidding. It's one of those where if you're kind of flipping through the channels and you see a movie here, a movie there, whatever, I might come back to that. Whenever I see Shawshank Redemption, it's like just kind of out of habit. I just flip the remote over my shoulder. I'm kind of glued in no matter what part we're on.
I get sucked in. I get sucked in on movies all the time, but especially on this one, you're absolutely right. I get annoyed because it has the commercials. And, you know, and like when you're watching, and you and I do a lot of work from home, different projects, different things. So the movie will be on during the daytime. And for those that don't have daytime TV, daytime hours, you're at an office, whatever, you probably don't know this. But like AMC or Sundance will go to show Shawshank Redemption, and they'll have it in a four-hour block or maybe a three-hour block where they're going to run a commercial every 5 minutes, Jay. So
sometimes it's better just to pause it.
Yes.
Kind of like, go catch up on it later on.
Do the technological workaround. That's right. Hit pause, do something else for a half hour, and then just speed through as many of the ads as possible while you watch the movie. I'm with you on that.
It really is like visiting old friends, though, whenever it comes on. And it's kind of hard not watching. It is kind of frustrating.
And you and I, again, I will just send you a text message that says TNT. And then you will say, Dufresne is in the hole or whatever when you send it back to me on this.
What's Norton doing right now?
Right, on this movie. So, okay, this is kind of the same game plan that we have followed throughout this. We'll talk about the beginnings of the movie. how it was made. We'll then give our thoughts kind of on the movie as well, and then some other interesting twists and plots. You actually hit me with something. I have seen this movie in part or in whole 50 times, The Shawshank Redemption, in the last 23 years. I remember seeing this movie not only in the theater, but I remember buying the videotape. I mean, the videotape, Jay Betzel, of this movie back in the 90s. I had that for my VCR, eventually got the DVD back in like the late 90s, but I had VHS of this movie.
You know, it's one of those two. Remember back in the VHS days, too, you know, let's kind of take up a little space on the counter and all that. It's kind of one of those, to buy a VHS, it had to be one of those, you know, you're going to watch over and over again, and that definitely fits this one. And I think what you're referring to is that I was telling you the other day, we were talking about Stephen King kind of being in the news lately with It being such a huge hit, I believe the all-time biggest September movie in the history of movies, you know, at the box office, and the fact that The Shawshank Redemption is actually based on a novella that Stephen King wrote for the book Different Seasons, and it was called Rita Hayworth and the Shawshank Redemption.
And I never knew that. In all these times that I've watched the movie, I never really did any kind of research into who wrote the story that this movie came out of, this fictionalized story that it came out of. I mean, I was curious, I think, at one point, Jay, whether it was somehow based, at least loosely, on some kind of a true story on somebody, because there's a lot of, I mean, you can believe a lot of what's in this movie in terms of prison life back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and how someone could potentially escape, etc. But I never really looked into it, and until the famous Jay Betzel told me, Stephen King wrote the series of books, I guess, that this kind of morphed into or part of this book. I guess it was like a short story that got converted into the movie, right?
And it also had the short story called The Body, which was turned into the movie Stand By Me, starring River Phoenix, directed by Rob Reiner. Big, big hit back in the day.
Wow.
That was a short story that was in this same book. I believe there was four stories.
How about that?
Two of them.
Well, and the interesting thing now that you and I have done a little research, and we're going to give our thoughts on this, but we're also going to kind of quiz each other along the way. And I should mention to the audience, we don't rehearse this. You and I have not gone over necessarily what I want to talk about or what you want to talk about.
Actually, so, tell you what, let me even tell them this. You and I were just talking when I mentioned that about Stephen King, and you basically told me to shut up. We need to be recording this.
Well, so right. You started to tell me about Stephen King and what you were doing when we were going to game plan recording the show, and I did. I told you. I said, stop. This is the show. Because I want this to be a natural reaction on this. So I had never really looked into it, and now I've looked into it, and the writer that adapted Stephen King's novella, as you put it, the short story, into the movie, he wrote it and he directed it, is Frank Darabont, if I have that name. And Frank was known more for horror movies, making horror movies in the 80s and the 90s. And now this became a serious, dramatic movie, and really his first foray into trying to do something serious besides horror movie. What do you think about that, the writer-director?
The funny thing is, you know, he wrote the screenplay, and Rob Reiner wanted to buy it from him and direct it himself. And basically, he kind of just went out on a limb and said, you know, I really want to do it on my own. And he turned down the $2.5 million to take the reins himself. And you are correct. I believe he had written A Nightmare on Elm Street 3, the one that the Dream Warriors episode,
right,
of the Nightmare on Elm Street series.
I lost track of how many of those they made, by the way. I don't remember how many of those they made, the Nightmare on Elm Street with Freddy Krueger.
Last one I remember
12,
was Freddy Jason,
27,
like 67.
63, Nightmare on Elm Streets. I have no idea how many they made. But he also wrote some Tales for the Crypt. I mean, he was a horror writer and director. That's his background, Darabont. And interesting that he gave Stephen King money for the idea here, that he was going to write the screenplay to or write the movie to, and Stephen King apparently never cashed the check, never cashed the $5,000 check. And then I didn't know that. He turned down from Rob Reiner?
$5 million from Rob Reiner. The funny thing, back to Stephen King for a minute, is I read that he gave him $5,000 check for it, because Stephen King said, there's no way that story can be adapted into a movie. Don't give me the money. And he's like, no, it's obvious. It'll be great. And Stephen King basically said, all right, we'll go for it. And he never cashed the check, and then whenever the movie got made, he framed it and gave him the check back.
That's amazing. So Darabont bought the movie, quote-unquote, air quotes, in 1987. It took a few years for him to bring it to the threshold of being made as a movie and being cast as a movie. And this is interesting. He got a decent budget, getting green-lighted from Castle Rock, the movie production house. And then they tried to figure out, okay, who are we going to cast as the lead? Who's going to end up with this? Do you know who Darren Bont really wanted as a couple of the guys that he really locked in on and said, this guy should be Andy Dufresne, the lead character? Do you know who he was originally shooting for as the original Andy Dufresne?
I saw in, I believe it was Variety, that Rob Reiner, when he was going to direct it, wanted to have Tom Cruise play Andy and Harrison Ford play Red.
Wow.
You imagine
that? I hadn't seen that one. I knew Cruise was in on the discussion, but I didn't hear about Harrison Ford. But apparently Darren Bont loved Gene Hackman and Robert Duvall, but they were both unavailable. Clint Eastwood, who obviously was very famous from the Escape from Alcatraz movie, the Birdman of Alcatraz movie, he was not available. Neither was Paul Newman. They couldn't get him. In that case, Darren Bont was looking for those guys to maybe play the character of Red. And then Cruise was involved, Tom Hanks. Tom Hanks was actually under consideration to be Andy Dufresne, Tim Robbins' character. But Tom Hanks was busy making Forrest Gump, and it was too involved, and the productions of the movie were going to, both movies were going to overlap. So it didn't work out. Man, could the world have been different if Tom Hanks instead of Tim Robbins ends up in the Shawshank Redemption, Jay?
Speaking of Forrest Gump, let's kind of revisit that for a second. 1994, we had Forrest Gump, Pulp Fiction, and the Shawshank Redemption all come out in a matter of weeks. Because basically, Forrest Gump came out around July 4th, Shawshank came out in September, and Pulp Fiction came out in October.
So, amazing.
In a matter of like 3 months, we had three of the greatest movies of all time come out.
And by the way, Kevin Costner, Kevin Costner was also under consideration, and somewhere around that time, instead of being able to make the Shawshank Redemption, he was making Waterworld, one of the bigger flops of the 1990s. And this is after Costner had been on a roll with Field of Dreams and Dances with Wolves and No Way Out. I mean, I'm going to leave one or two of them out here. Bull Durham and all the movies that he was making early 90s. The Bodyguard. He flopped badly with Waterworld. That kept him from being able to be Andy Dufresne in this movie. Costner.
I think Costner would have been good as Andy Dufresne, but let's just be real. This movie is perfect. It all worked out perfect. The people that are in it, you know, are the perfect actors to play these parts.
As it turned out. Robbins, by the way, had a casting session with Darren Bont, the writer-director, and he cast Robbins after watching him in a horror movie, what else, in Jacob's Ladder. And so that's how that came about. And you're exactly right. I mean, the convergence, and we've talked about this before, you really have to have three elements in order to have a great movie, a movie that's going to stand the test of time like The Shawshank Redemption has, Jay, in my opinion. The convergence is you've got to have a great story. You've got to have something that people are going to buy into. The second thing is it's got to be written well. You may have a great story, but if you don't have somebody that can write the story, essentially tell the story to you, or tell it to the actors who are going to tell it to you, you're in big trouble. And then the actors, the star power, the actors that bring the story to life. Example, the story that Aaron Sorkin came up with, that it was actually a play, A Few Good Men. We'll probably end up doing A Few Good Men on We've Seen That at some point.
I can guarantee you.
We're going to do that one at some point because at the time we're talking, like, the 25th anniversary of that one's coming up. But that is a great story that Aaron Sorkin came up with, and then he wrote the daylights out of that. I mean, he wrote a phenomenal screenplay and script, but the movie is made, like you were just mentioning, Tim Robbins and Morgan Freeman making the movie as their characters. The movie is made by Cruise and Jack Nicholson, and them squaring off, obviously, in the ultimate final scenes there of that movie when Cruise as Danny Caffey is cross-examining Nathan Jessup, Colonel Jessup, on the stand. It's the actors that are telling the story that bring it to life, and that's the same to bring it back to Shawshank Redemption. You had those factors in place. Stephen King's story, Darren Bont writing it, and then Robbins and and also Morgan Freeman telling it. That's the convergence of those three things is what makes the movie. Tell me more about what you're looking for in a movie, and do you agree with me that if you have those three ingredients, that's where you get a winner?
I agree 100%. It's the perfect storm. You know Morgan Freeman is, you know Tim Robbins is, but in this movie, Tim Robbins is Andy. He's not Tim Robbins, and Morgan Freeman is Red. And, you know, Warden Norton, we've seen him in movies like Demolition Man and, you know, Ace Ventura. We've seen him in other movies, but in this movie, he is Warden Norton, and he is evil.
Yeah, and we'll get to that here in a few minutes. All right, so they casted, cast these different people. How about this? There were some interesting guys that were being, they had feelers out for different parts in this movie. For example, the young convict Tommy that comes to the prison, who later on has a chance to exonerate Andy Dufresne's character for the alleged murder of his wife and her lover. Do you know the actor that was under strong consideration and actually was cast for the role of Tommy, but didn't end up in the movie?
I believe that would be Mr. Brad Pitt.
How about that name? Brad Pitt, cast originally as Tommy, dropped out because he was going on to be part of Thelma and Louise with Susan Sarandon and Gina Davis, which ended up being a huge movie, and Brad Pitt obviously launched his career in and around that time in the 90s and onward. But he was almost in The Shawshank Redemption. They originally cast him for that. How about also in this movie, there are different characters, including the prisoner that ends up being one of the prison rapists, Boggs, and James Gandolfini was cast initially, got the role, and then couldn't come to an agreement and passed on that. Tony Soprano, long before we knew he was Tony Soprano, was almost in The Shawshank Redemption.
Jay. Yeah, and I like James Gandolfini as an actor, but I think Mark Ralston was perfect as Boggs. He just had that sleaziness to him, you know, and where he didn't come across as like James Gandolfini in his movies is a bigger guy. You know, he comes across as kind of intimidating. Mark Ralston just looked evil.
And sometimes in these roles, I mean, like in that one, maybe Gandolfini looked at the role and said, I don't want to be typecast. I don't want to be known necessarily for that. I don't want to take that risk. I mean, I don't know. He's now passed away. I don't know if he ever gave an interview about why he didn't stay with that role. But, I mean, that's not a character you would point to and say, hey, this is one of my great roles. This is what I want to be known for, a prison rapist in The Shawshank Redemption. So maybe he thought about that. His management team, his advisors, whoever they are, said to him, maybe you don't want this role here on Shawshank Redemption, and maybe that's the reason why.
That's possible. Like kind of what I was saying about the other big names we talked about in the other roles, this one just worked out perfect, all of them. I mean, everybody, you know, Gil Bellows playing Tommy, the part that was going to go to Brad Pitt. You know, back then when this movie came out, Brad Pitt wasn't what he was now. He was a guy who'd been on the TV show Dallas. You know, and he'd had the small part in Thelma and Louise. I mean, little did we know. I mean, watching it now, we might look at it and go, wow, that's Brad Pitt. You know, but, I mean, I think all the casting in this is perfect. Clancy Brown playing Byron Hadley, cool. Great, great.
As the ultimate prison guard turned bad, the ultimate corrupt thug prison guard that's really the henchman for Warden Norton, played by Bob Gunton. So, yeah, there are some interesting characters. And you mentioned Bob Gunton having been in Demolition Man and some other things. Of course, he was later on, and I'm a big fan of Kiefer Sutherland's 24 and the whole series in the 2000s. He was actually on a season of 24 as like the advisor to the president, the director of national security or something. But every time I was watching him, I kept looking at him going, that's the warden from Shawshank Redemption. That's what Bob Gunton's going to forever be known for.
He's like Ralph Macchio. He just typecast into that part with the Karate Kid.
Exactly. Okay, so here's a quick pop quiz from what Stephen King wrote originally. I think a lot of people would wonder if all these characters are the same character. Are they all the same character from the novel into the actual screenplay in the movie?
Well, I know that Morgan Freeman's character in the book was Irish.
Right.
And he had red hair.
And so obviously that was a stretch for Ellis Boyd, Red Redding, to be played by Morgan Freeman. But yeah, that is the case. How about this?
They left in the movie where he said, maybe it's because I'm Irish.
Yes. Good little peek into that.
Little wink for those who read the novel.
Little wink and nod. Well, how about in the case of Warden Norton? Warden Norton doesn't actually exist the way that I understand it in the novella, the short story by Stephen King. It's actually a series of wardens that are corrupt, one after the other, because Dufresne is in prison for so long in the Shawshank Redemption. So, again, this is the screenplay and how Darren Bont, the writer-director, struck gold, because the movie works even better with one evil warden behind the scenes who's corrupt, who's lording over the prisoners and taking money as kickbacks, and there's brutality going on, and he's not paying attention to it, and that's his job. So he made it one central character, Warden Norton, the fictitious character in this case that's not even in the novel, and boy, does that work for the movie. I don't think the movie works as well if you don't have Norton, the warden, as the antagonist for Andy Dufresne and for the rest of the prisoners. What do you think?
Oh, no, I agree. Definitely we needed the character the way it was because of the fact that him and Andy had the relationship with Andy, you know, taking care of his money and hiding it and everything to make sure that he wouldn't have to pay the taxes and he'd have all this money that he's got. It would be invested in the right spots and, you know, tucked away and sheltered, shall we say, in the right spots. But I wanted to also mention while you're talking about the different characters, in the novella, Tommy does not get killed. He trades the information with the warden to get to go to a nicer prison. So that character changed a lot for the movie, too, because, you know, in the movie he gets killed by Byron Hadley and it makes it look like they're going to escape because the warden doesn't want Andy going anywhere because he needs somebody to take care of his money.
And it works, and it works mainly for this reason, because throughout the movie there are reminders. One, you're in here for life or very little chance of parole. So you have no hope in that regard, and hope comes up in the movie. And remember, Red Redding tells Andy Dufresne, hope's a very dangerous thing in here. You're talking about hope. You can't have hope. You're not getting out of here. But the reminder every once in a while that you can be beaten to death or killed by the guards is the way that you keep everybody in line. It's the way that you keep control. And so the movie works even better because of that, because there was the blatant, brutal, immediate reminder for Dufresne and the rest of the prisoners, if you don't go along ultimately with Norton and his henchmen and their plan and all the evil they're doing, they will kill you. And they will make it seem as though you were trying to escape or they had a reason to kill you, but they will kill you at Shawshank Prison. Yeah, no doubt. And also, who's going to believe you over believing the warden and the guards? They will get away with it. Okay, so that begs another question. Let's have fun with this part of it again as we talk on this edition of We've Seen That. T.J. Reeves, the famous J.J. Betzel, is with me, and we're talking about Shawshank Redemption. A lot of people may not know this without looking it up. Let's talk about the actual setting to the movie, which is supposed to be a prison, Shawshank Prison in the state of Maine. True or false? On the location shoot, did they use a prison in Maine, in New England, even in the states of Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Vermont, Maine, or not?
I'm going to go out on a limb and say false, that I believe they did it like in Ohio or something.
You are correct. They used a reformatorium or an asylum in Ohio and shot this thing in Ohio, and when production began and filming began, they had $25 million in 1993 for the budget for this. They chose that location, and it's in Mansfield, Ohio, and as well in neighboring Ashland, Ohio. So not in Maine, but in Ohio. When you see the Shawshank Redemption again, and the famous oak tree that becomes a central part of the story, because when Dufresne breaks out, he has told Red where to find a stash of cash and the instructions on how to find him, and to find it under an oak tree that he supposedly asked his wife to marry him on a picnic under that oak tree. The oak tree was actually located in a state park in Lucas, Ohio, but unfortunately that oak tree, many, many years after the movie was shot and made, damaged in a storm and was lost in a violent storm in 2016. Does that take something away, J. Jay Betzel from you that the movie's not actually shot even in New England or in Maine, and it was shot somewhere else, and to find out now that that all of that stuff doesn't really exist where Hollywood tried to portray that it does exist?
Not in the least. I thought this movie was awesome.
Well, I think, and it's interesting, too, about the tree and about finding the tree and what was it you're going to find, a rock that doesn't belong there, a black igneous rock, rock that doesn't belong there, and look under the rock and you'll find the instructions to find me. So the there are interesting aspects, obviously, to this movie going back and forth and some things that I've looked at, some things that you've looked at. You and I are big golf fans, and at the time that we're talking, we love competitive golf. We love when the countries play golf. The United States has just played in the President's Cup against the international team and destroyed them in New Jersey at Liberty National Golf Club. But when they're playing team golf, when they're playing match play team golf, they play something called alternate shot, where you take turns. You hit a shot, your partner then hits the next shot. You hit it off the tee, your partner hits the second shot. You hit the third, he hits the putt, et cetera, et cetera. Let's play alternate shot. Shall we do this kind of like the golf version that we've been watching recently? Let's play some alternate shot back and forth on Shawshank Redemption. What do you think?
Go for it.
All right. So I covered where the movie was shot, and I think it's interesting there about the oak tree. I thought it was interesting, too, that in a lot of the prison scenes, apparently most of those were shot on location. They were not shot in California. They didn't build a soundstage, per se, in California. Most of this movie was apparently shot at that location in Mansfield, Ohio. How about that? Most of the scenes shot there, and the movie was shot, I believe I saw this, over the span of about 4 months in 1993. At times, they were working 6 and 7 days a week to get it shot with the prison scenes. Does that surprise you that they didn't use Hollywood and sound stages and sets for some of it?
Not really. I mean, especially because obviously Frank Darabont has shown that this is like a passion project for him. So I think he had it set in his mind that he was going to do everything the way he wanted. You know, you were talking about the long days. I read somewhere, I read a few things on Vanity Fair and Variety when I was doing the research for us chatting about this. One of the things I saw was they would do sometimes 16 to 18 hours a day, and he would demand multiple takes on things, and him and Morgan Freeman got into it a few times, with Morgan Freeman saying, why are we doing this again? We've already done it 3 times. You know, so, I mean, if he's going to be that micromanaging and that technical, I could certainly imagine him wanting to do it on a location that fits what he wants and not just a soundstage.
Yeah, and so, you know, eventually, I guess they got on the same page with that, with the number of takes. And again, in the case of Tim Robbins, Morgan Freeman was not, at this time, a superstar yet. He was a known Hollywood actor. He'd been in Driving Miss Daisy. He'd been in other films. Robbins, clearly not a superstar yet. He'd done Bull Durham with Costner and Sarandon. But this movie It made their careers, don't you think, Jay? I mean, this movie is what they're known for.
Hey, we're talking about Tim Robbins. Don't forget Howard the Duck. Wasn't he in that?
Yeah, Howard the Duck and Jacob's Ladder, like we talked about with all those. But, I mean, this movie made them. So all the takes, all the extra aggravation, all the extra work, this movie made them.
But it made them over time. You know, when it first came out, they had a $25 million budget and it grossed $28 million. But over time, especially involving Ted Turner's TNT, you know, Ted Turner had acquired Castle Rock Pictures.
All right, wait a minute. It sounds like to me you're playing alternate shots, so you go.
Yeah, he had the right to this movie, and he showed it on TNT a lot. You know, and basically it was something he could show that wouldn't cost him a lot.
Do we know what Turner paid? Do we know what he paid to buy it when he bought it? It can't have been that much because, again, the movie was not a smash.
He bought the whole studio. He didn't buy just the movie.
Right.
He bought the whole studio. I'm not sure what it cost, but, you know, they had, like, Misery and, you know, all those Rob Reiner movies were from Castle Rock.
Right. So including a few Good Men and a few others, yeah. Right?
Right. Yeah, but I'm not positive what it cost him. But, I mean, basically it gave him, you know, programming for TNT. And that's one of the things that I was reading where it said that Shawshank Redemption, based off of, like, you know, people like you that bought it on VHS and DVD, you know, and all of the TV licensing, because it comes on, as you said, at pretty much every station. It comes on all the time. If it says the movie ended up making over $100 million. And there's even an article where Bob Gunton, who played Warden Norton, said that he still earned six-figure residual payments as of 2004 when it was having
God, and it's basically from the re-showing of the movie. All right, yeah. Because technology exists, and I know some fans may have done this while they're listening to us because you can look things up immediately on your phone. So Turner Broadcasting bought New Line Cinema and Castle Rock at the same time. This was in August of 1993. So this was prior to this movie being released, but they bought both of them for the purpose of being able to show them all the time on Turner's networks. They paid $667 million at that time. Good God. How much money did Ted Turner have flowing around from CNN, TBS Cable, owning the Atlanta Braves? At one time, he also owned the Atlanta Hawks before he sold them. He had $667 million to buy two different movie entities, two different movie corporations, and to be able to reshow all of their movies over and over again. So that's how he got his hands on them, Jay.
He's not ever going to be hurting. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, that's incredible that he was able to come up with that. All right, so more on the alternate shot. How about the original time of the movie? You have a guess on how long the original movie was supposed to be, finished product from Darren Bont and the production staff?
I'm going to go 3 hours and 10 minutes.
3 hours, 10, a little long. It was originally 2 hours, 35 minutes. And then the studio rejected that and wanted several scenes cut, including longer scenes of Red post-incarceration trying to adjust to his life. They, you know, towards the end of the movie, that's obviously in the final moments of the movie, they really sped that process up where it's almost like Red goes ahead and tries to find Andy like the second day he's out of prison after the big escape. But plausibly, you would think that he would wait around in case he's being watched, etc. Common sense, right? That would have taken weeks, if not months, before he would have made the attempt to go find the rock under the tree, go find the money, go find the secret coded message, go find the message of where to find Andy Dufresne. Ultimately, he wouldn't have done that in a day or two, is my point.
No, but you know that he was unhappy working at that grocery store, and he was unhappy in that place he was living. You know, or he'd even said he thought about doing some stuff to get put back in jail. You know, similar to Brooks when Brooks had been let out, you know, because they were institutionalized, I believe is how they phrase it in the movie. And one of the things that I had seen was that Frank Darabont was very highly influenced by Goodfellas when he was putting the screenplay together, you know, and especially having the narration. So by virtue of Morgan Freeman narrating when he had gotten out, I think it was kind of easier to tell that it happened over time that he was debating on what to do, because he was so unhappy. So I think that it's kind of a given that it wasn't, I'm here one day and I'm going to go look for Andy. I think it's portrayed based off of a lot of stuff that he says in his narration, that he really, he's kind of torn on what to do, but he's basically like, I doubt that they'll be come looking for me anyways, remember?
That is very true. An old con like me. How about this, while we're playing alternate shots, so you hit me with something, I'm going to hit you with something. Is that the original end to the movie? I think I've loaded up the question well enough. Is it the original end of the movie where Red and Andy are reunited on the beach with him working on the boat?
I'm going to go out on a limb and say no.
It is not the original end of the movie. In fact, Darren Bont wanted to end the movie with Red on the bus. And I always love this about filmmakers. I remember taking filmmaking classes in college. It wasn't that long ago. Okay, it was a while ago. But I remember hearing filmmakers talk, being interviewed inside the actor's studio, whatever the case is, James Lipton, and those blue cards, hearing them talk at different times on DVDs and bonus features. Great filmmakers, Jay, and I want your thought on this, often let you decide how the movie should end. They leave it up to you. They leave it ambiguous, where you have to decide, did so-and-so really go back to try to reconcile with his ex? Did so-and-so actually get away with murder, or did the cops find him? I mean, speaking of another...
CJ, what about the ending of Basic Instinct?
Yes.
When Stone and Michael Douglas are in bed.
Made, by the way, right around the same time. What, like 1992, 1993, right?
Correct, right.
And the ending of the movie is what? And the ending of the movie is what in that case?
In the ending of Basic Instinct?
Yes.
It fades to black, and then it comes back with the two of them in bed, and it scrolls down underneath the bed to show an ice pick. And then basically it goes to black screen there, and it leaves the audience to decide, do you think she killed him? Because, you know, the whole movie she kept telling him, you know, you're going to die in the book, you know. And pretty much everybody she knew died.
Right.
And you know, you find out, like, oh, I want to say maybe 10 years later when Basic Instinct 2 came out, that the basis of that movie is her having killed Michael Douglas and moving into England.
Right.
So, if you paid attention to the movie, you knew she did it, but it still kind of left it open interpretation.
But in that instance, yes, they let you decide how it's going to end, and you can go back through numerous different movies and you know, you're trying to figure out, okay, how does this movie really end? Perfect example, back to Gandolfini and The Sopranos, because it's left open-ended forever, and I wasn't a big fan of that show and didn't watch all the shows, but I certainly watched the climactic final couple of episodes, including the final scene, where, again, in that case, the writers, the director, everybody involved faded to black when someone came in the diner and the bell rang on the door and you didn't know what happened. You're left to decide on your own what happened.
Basically started playing Journey.
Yes, and then play Don't Stop Believin' while it's going on and make that song famous for all time. So originally, Darren Bont wants to let the audience figure out on Shawshank Redemption, does Red go find Andy Dufresne? Does he get there? Does he make it there? Or when he gets to Zay Guantanamo, the place, the fictitious place that is supposed to be at the Mexican border, that is across from Fort Hancock, Texas, that when he gets there, is Andy Dufresne still there? Or when he gets there, is Dufresne somehow gone? Is Dufresne recaptured? Remember, this is the 1960s. They don't have the internet. You don't have cell phones. Maybe somebody, the U.S. Marshals, whomever, have captured Andy Dufresne. After all, he's an escaped murderer, right?
Essentially, yes. But I'm glad it ended the way it did. I thought it was really cool when he's walking up to him. I mean, I thought it was the perfect ending because it didn't show them hanging out or what they're doing. It kind of left that open to thinking about these guys kind of, you know, friends living happily ever after.
Okay, you got something else for me on alternate shot here, back and forth like we're playing golf. Give me something else about Shawshank Redemption while we play that on We've Seen That.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay, now remember the part when they're doing roll call and they find Andy's cells empty.
Oh, the scene of the movie. Remember it. It's the scene of the movie when Norton pulls that poster off the wall, and the musical score is playing at that moment, and you realize he has escaped with Thomas Newman's score playing in the background. That is the ultimate scene of the movie.
Well, do you remember who was on the poster?
Was it Lana Turner?
It was Raquel Welch.
Well, yeah, because he
showed over time. Because remember, Rita Hayworth was the first poster.
Rita Hayworth is there, and he looks over at Raquel Welch and says, "Maybe we should ask that cupcake on the wall. What say you, Fuzzy Britches?" Because she's got the cavewoman outfit on, right?
Yes.
But
he throws one of the rocks at the poster, and it goes through the wall.
Would you? Yes. Would you not agree? The cinematography, the shot of from inside the tunnel. When he peels that poster away, that's an iconic shot in a movie that says it all. When Bob Gunton pulls the poster away and the camera is in the tunnel and you see that it's a tunnel and that Dufresne has escaped, that lives with me 25 years later. It will probably live with me 25 years from now. When you think Shawshank Redemption, you think that scene, do you not?
Absolutely, and you also remember right around that time in the movie was when Morgan Freeman's character, Red, was kind of worried about Andy because he had asked somebody for some extra rope.
Right.
He thought he had been kind of down, especially after Tommy being killed, and he was worried about him that he might hang himself. You know, and he just basically showed that no one really knew what Andy was up to.
And in truth, he accidentally realized... Because, and again, if you've seen the movie as many times as we have, we're taking things for granted, but I would think most people that are listening to this have seen it a bunch. basically Dufresne's idea to escape, and that dangerous word hope, comes from a rock hammer, a sculpting hammer that Red got him, and he accidentally, while putting his initials in the wall, knocked a piece of the wall out. Again, brilliantly written here, that he would accidentally give himself hope that I could dig a tunnel out of my cell, out of my corner cell here, and get out into the sewage system and escape. And the idea kind of came to him, and it again did not happen, materialize over the course of days or weeks or months, but apparently over several years he was carrying the rocks from that tunnel out of his cell in his shorts, in his pockets, and dumping it out in the yard where no one would notice what he was up to. But it was completely by chance with the rock hammer that he gave himself hope and created that tunnel and created the idea and the thought that I can escape.
Yeah, and remember there was the part where Warden Norton had also threatened to take him out of that little corner suite, I believe is what he called it, and throw him back into a spot with someone else, and then basically not protect him from the sisters with the guards. So he kind of played along with Warden Norton because he knew he needed that spot so he could be able to escape.
Okay, so again, the movie works for so many different reasons. The fact that in true Hollywood fashion, Dufresne is able to escape, get away, and then tell everyone, tell the world through the media that Norton is an evil warden and all of the prison brutality and the murders that have gone on and the corruption that's gone on. So as it turns out, that's a just plot twist. In that one, did you think as you watched it, and I don't know how well you recall watching it the first time, but I kept thinking that somehow, some way, something bad was going to happen to Dufresne, even though he got away. He's had bad luck to be in prison, wrong place, wrong time to begin with. I felt like that the twist here was going to be they catch him, they kill him while trying to apprehend him. That kind of thing. I didn't see a happy ending, a clean getaway.
The first time I saw it, God, it's been so long. I didn't know that he was going to escape for sure. I figured that he was going to at least give it a try, especially after Tommy got killed. But it was just really hard to say because there's so many different ways it could have gone. And I mean, like I've said multiple times over the last few minutes, that I just think everything they did in this was perfect, and I wouldn't change a thing.
All right, we'll keep playing Alternate Shot for a few more minutes, talking Shawshank Redemption, one of our favorites. And again, this movie is on constantly, especially on the weekends, as we've laid out on Turner's TNT or TBS or now AMC, which I guess that's also a Turner. That used to be a Turner divisional property there, a movie classics channel. It seems to be on all the time. How many Academy Awards did Shawshank Redemption get nominated for? Pop quiz.
I know it was nominated for 7 and won 0.
How about that? You even got the follow-up correct. Hard to believe that it was nominated for that many and didn't win anything. And again, it was up against some different movies in that time frame. Forrest Gump obviously dominated. Pulp Fiction out at the box office as well. So, yeah, I mean, amazing that it was nominated for that many Academy Awards and didn't win one. A lot of the pundits weren't thrilled with the movie, but again, what truly stands the test of time is that the movie worked then, and it has been shown so often and has done so well on VHS, DVD rental, and now download. That's the ultimate vindication, I guess, for it not doing as well at the box office or not being as successful in terms of awards. Would you agree?
You know, people talk about word of mouth and stuff, and I've met a lot of people over my little life, and I've never met anyone who didn't like this movie. And that's the thing, is if you talk to someone who hadn't seen it, which is very rare, but if you do talk to someone who's seen it, it's one of those things where you need to go see it now. And if they actually follow through on what you tell them, then they come back and thank you for it.
Yeah, great movie. There's no doubt. And there's a couple more things to share about. Man, I'm looking at some of the numbers just here, what I have in front of me.
Shot real quick while you're looking.
Play Alternate Shot on me. Hit me.
Yeah, Frank Darabont did not direct another movie for 5 years after Shawshank Redemption. Do you know what it was?
Did he go back to horror movies? I don't know what it was.
Another Stephen King prison movie, The Green Mile, starring Tom Hanks.
Wow. So after trying to get Hanks to play Andy Dufresne, he instead convinces Hanks to play the prison guard in The Green Mile.
You are correct, sir.
How about that? Love the famous Jay with the little nuggets. So you mentioned $28 million is what it cleared at the box office, just a little more than what the budget was. You know what Forrest Gump cleared that year worldwide?
Oh, gosh. I'm not positive on worldwide.
Hey, let me stop you. It's a whole lot more than $28 million, so go north of that.
I'm going to go, in America, I'm going to say $300 million.
Yeah, it was over $300. It's $330 million worldwide.
It was right there with Lion King. I remember the two of them went back and forth, and they were released like a couple weeks apart, and they just went. I think Forrest Gump was at the theaters for like 42 weeks or something insane like that.
I remember I saw Forrest Gump at least twice at the theater. I can't remember if I saw Shawshank Redemption twice or not at the theater.
I did not see Shawshank at the theater. I saw it on video.
I would frequently go see movies a second time a lot of the time. And I remember that, but yeah, that's incredible that Forrest Gump made 10, 11 times, 12 times the money at the box office with
DeLorean and go in the Wayback Machine for a minute. You know, back in the day when these movies came out, they didn't have three or four new movies coming out every single week. You know, if a movie came out, it was usually in the theaters for a few weeks unless it was a complete bomb, you know, and like a movie like Forrest Gump, you know, the way the movie theaters would work back then, I'm not sure if it's the same way now, was, you know, the first weekend, you know, it would be like 95% to 5% of the money would go back to the studio. But the longer the theater had the movie, it would gradually work its way down where the theater got to keep some of the box office. So for that, for a movie to be out 42 weeks like Forrest Gump, it might have even gone flipped where the movie theater itself was getting 80% of the profit there. So they love those words now, you know, and also back then, remember, 6-7 months after a movie came out, it would come out on home video. A year after it came out, it would come on HBO or Showtime, which
that's right.
Had to go with the studio, where now, you know, within basically 6 weeks, it'll be on video, and within 6 months, it'll be on HBO.
Well, and the fascinating thing about the point that you're making here is a lot of times you had to go to the theater to be able to see the movie, and then when it was gone, you didn't have a way to see it for a while, and if you really enjoyed it, that was a void. Now, we're so spoiled, Jay. I mean, you can basically, as you're mentioning, see the movie 16 different ways, and people can't fathom that any longer, that back in the 80s and the 90s when we do these podcasts, man, you saw something like A Few Good Men or Forrest Gump or Shawshank Redemption or The Breakfast Club or Hoosiers or all these different movies that we love.
When A Few Good Men would come out on VHS, it would cost $100 to buy it. That's why you had to rent it. And then 6 months later, it would come out for sale for $20.
Right. And then you would go, to Blockbuster, and they would have a wall with all the different movie cases, and A Few Good Men would have 50 movie cases, but no movie inside of any of them because the movie was gone every time.
Sparky kid behind the counter. I'm sorry, sir. Those are all checked out.
Yes, exactly. For the Shawshank Redemption. Okay, a couple of more, just kind of going back and forth, like alternate shot on this. We mentioned all the Academy Awards and all of the different stuff. You mentioned Darren Bont and the Green Mile. Tim Robbins was such a sympathetic character in this movie, but for years he became a much better villain in a lot of these movies that he made later in the 90s and the 2000s. I'm thinking of Antitrust, right, was the computer movie where he ends up being the computer bad guy. Oh, help me out. What's the terrorist movie where he's the domestic terrorist going against Jeff Bridges?
Arlington Road,
very good. Thank you. So he became much more of a bad guy, didn't he?
Besides The Shawshank Redemption, is The Player. It's a really good Robert Altman movie about the movie industry, and it's made, like, I believe 92 is when it was released, and it's got pretty much every movie star in the world: Bruce Willis, Julia Roberts, John Cusack, Burt Reynolds. Like, everybody back in that day is in that movie, and it's kind of a satire on the movie industry. If you have not seen that, highly recommend The Player.
All right, so go see The Player. Anything else from you on alternate shot?
Let me see. Okay, I'll come up with one that's pretty simple. So whenever the prisoners are all watching that movie with Rita Hayworth, do you know what movie that is?
I do not. Hit me.
Gilda from 1946. Kind of give you an idea of when that was.
Well, and they watch that movie over and over again because, remember, Red is saying to, I think, Andy in that instance, hold on, because he wants to see the woman flip her hair, wants to see Rita Hayworth flip her hair.
Oh, yeah.
In that instance. I just saw this nugget while doing our research here. by 2013, for the audience and for Jay, do you have a guess how many different cable networks at one point or another had shown The Shawshank Redemption? Have a guess of the number?
15.
15 different cable networks.
That's it. That's right.
15 is correct.
Wow.
And it's amazing that, again, the movie stands the test of time, and the Academy of Motion Pictures celebrated the 20th anniversary, showing the screening in Beverly Hills. It later was named the American Film Institute Top 100 Movies of the 1900s. And again, this is a movie that was adapted by Frank Darabont, a horror movie maker, to go back to the beginning of our conversation. He wrote from like a small idea, a short story, this entire movie. It's an incredible story about how this got made into a full-length 2-hour plus. I don't know that we ever covered it. 2 hours and 25-minute movie or thereabouts. 2 hours and 20-minute movie thereabouts. It's incredible that he wrote that kind of movie off of something that was apparently a short story, very simple, and it has stood the test of time 25 years later, Jay.
No doubt. Speaking of later on, there's something I saw that said that Andy stole $370,000 from Warden Norton in 1966, and adjusted for inflation now, it would be $2.7 million.
That is a lot of money, and remember the line.
He basically sheltered for the warden.
And remember the line, consider it severance, as Red said, for how many ever years that he was in prison. That was his severance money to get away and to get away with his life. Interesting also that in Mansfield, Ohio, in 2013, where they filmed the movie at the asylum, the reformatorium that doubled as the prison, that they had a film festival for the 20th anniversary of the film. They ended up showing the movie at the Renaissance Theater in Mansfield, Ohio, and ended up Gunton, the actor who played Warden Norton, and others were able to attend. They signed autographs. No Tim Robbins, no Morgan Freeman at that one. Darabont sent a video greeting the fans who were there. There were more than 6,000 people who came for the events and the screening of the movie on the 20th anniversary for that weekend in 2013. Back a few years ago on the 20th anniversary. So now, on the filming of the movie, now a few years later, it still stands the test of time on Shawshank Redemption. So any closing thoughts here from you and I now that we've covered this on We've Seen That with the classic that is the Tim Robbins, Morgan Freeman prison escape movie, Shawshank Redemption?
I'm going to go out and just say this, that I haven't actually thought all the way through on this, but if I was going to make a top 10, like my favorite movies, this would be in my top 10, guaranteed. You know, you and I joke around about how I love the Lethal Weapon movies and
right.
Die Hard, or how Can't Buy Me Love with Amanda Peterson was like my first crush and stuff like that. But yeah, so I got all these different movies that have their different spots, but there's no way I could make a top 10 list without making this in there somewhere because it is a perfect movie.
You know what? I'm not sucking up to you, but I have to agree. I think that any top 10 from the 80s and the 90s has to have this in it. Because, again, we're talking about it at the time that we are talking 23 years after the movie came out. That's a true test to how good the movie is. The fact that the movie is still on and is still getting ratings on cable channels 20 years after it was released tells you the effectiveness of the movie. Because they know that people that are in their 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s that saw this movie over and over again in the 90s and the early 2000s will watch it. Like we do on Basic Kid. You're sucked in. It's such a great story with such great acting.
Well, you know, it's funny. We've talked so many times over the years about all these movies we've seen, and, oh, man, if they remade that, who would be in this? There's no way they can remake it.
No.
First off, they wouldn't do it because the studios wouldn't have a comic book character to sell or anything. But at the same time, these guys are these characters. There's no way. You know, like we talked about the potential of having a box office bonanza back in the 90s of Harrison Ford and Tom Cruise in the same movie, and this is better.
Incredible. So, again, Shawshank Redemption, we hopefully gave you some different stories, anecdotes, some things you didn't know about the movie. I know it'll be on again soon. We'll get to see it again. And you and I, aside from the podcast and the on-demand show here, we'll be texting each other. You'll send me a text that says Sundance, or I'll send you one that says TNT. And we'll cut it on, and then we'll be watching Shawshank and then commiserating. Any closing words, Jay Betzel?
I will say this, if anyone would like to talk to me about Shawshank Redemption or The Play or any other movies, they can always find me on Twitter at TheFamousJay.
Yeah, go to the Twitter handle, The Famous Jay. You can find me as well on Twitter at Buck Sideline Guy, BUC, for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, who I broadcast for, at Buck Sideline Guy. We're both available as well on Facebook and Instagram under our names. Spell Betzel, B-E-T-S-I-L-L. Spell Reeves, R-I-V-E-S. You'll find us on Facebook, on social media. And, of course, find us through this show, because, again, we remind the audience we have done numerous ones of these, whether we're talking about Hoosiers, we've done sports ones, Tin Cup, Jason Bourne movies, different ones of these. So I'm thrilled. You know, you were saying about Lethal Weapon and the action movies and all the superhero movies that we have now in the 2010s that everybody comes out that have billion-dollar budgets and all the special effects. Shawshank Redemption is different because there's not bang-bang, blow-em-up, action, computer-generated sci-fi and stunt doubles. It's just good old-fashioned acting and characters and plot line, and that's why it works for me. I love that. I love having that as an alternative to sitting and watching futuristic sci-fi laser gun battles all the time in these movies now, Jay.
Well, yeah, and, you know, back when this movie came out, you know, that was the day when you had Arnold Schwarzenegger in True Lies, you had Sylvester Stallone cliffhanger, and, you know, the
Demolition Man that Warden Norton was in, yeah.
Snipes and Passenger 57, Steven Seagal and Under Siege.
Die Hard movies, yeah.
Distance. Yeah, I mean, those were the big hits. I mean, the fact that this even got made and it had much of a budget at all to be able to afford Tim Robbins and Morgan Freeman to do it, it's kind of a little minor miracle in itself.
It is the Shawshank Redemption. All right, we've had fun. Did you have fun, Famous Jay?
I'm always down to talk movies, TJ.
We are as well. Again, find us wherever you found us. Find us on iTunes as well. You can find us again on social media. We've seen that 80s, 90s movies podcast and more. As we talk about this, we'll come back at some point. I mean, there are a lot of other movies that we're going to go over between you and I. I had a blast on this one. For the Famous Jay, Jay Betzel in Fort Worth, Texas, I'm TJ Reeves in the west coast of Florida. Thanks for being with us on We've Seen That, the 80s and 90s movies podcast. Bye.
See you later.